people running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
I got involved with Code Pink Women for Peace when in the Bush era, that just tipped me over the edge. And they organized a delegation to go to Gaza in 2009 after Operation Cast Lead. So that Operation Cast Lead was December 08 to 09 in January. And it horrified me so much. We went in March. They organized it for March 2009. And going there changed my life. We spent a week there directly following the incredible massacres and demolition and devastation to sewage treatment plants, water supplies. Hospitals were bombed. We went to the UN school that was bombed. Many, many thousand, I think it was 1,500 people massacred, children, women, their port was destroyed against international law. And I had never witnessed that. You can read about it as much as you want, but when you witness it, there's this visceral, for me, a very visceral response. And that's what changed my world around Palestine. And to tip the scales even further, to understand that the U.S. was so complicit and supportive of this incredibly Zionistic Israeli regime that was responsible for it. And we give them millions and billions of dollars. And children were showing us these shells that had Made in USA. I mean, everyone there is very educated about who's funding it, and they don't really know why, but of course they know that they are at the receiving end of this horrific violence. And when I came back, my kids said, "Mom, you've never been the same since you came back from that trip." And my kids are in their 30s, so it wasn't, they were old enough to know as well. So that's basically how I became involved, and on all different levels then, coming back and trying to do local work and support the boycott, divestment, sanction efforts, writing to my representatives, going to rallies, organizing events to help educate, going to schools and talking and giving PowerPoints and helping, because I didn't know. I had no idea, and I still believe most Americans don't fully comprehend, like many places in the world. But this was just, this was the one place that I'd gone to that shifted.
Your story is similar to Alison Ware's.
Mm-hmm. If Americans knew. Yes.
That's right.
I really appreciate her site, her efforts, and I always have a stack of her wonderful postcards that I buy by the hundreds, and I take them around when I travel, and they are on all of my tables and presentations, and I put them throughout the airport. I put them in the bathrooms. I put them on the computer tables at the airport. Because her picture of the disappearing Palestine speaks volumes. And if you don't know, you don't know. And we don't teach accurate history in our culture here.
How did you get hooked up with the Freedom Flotilla?
Well, I've always continued to work with Code Pink. And basically, there was a group of U.S. folks, U.S. boats to Gaza, that wanted to be a part of the flotilla, which has been going on since 2008. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition started a couple years after that, but there were four or five boats that went in earlier in 08, and we followed in their courageous, monumental footsteps. Those were the only boats that did get into Gaza, and we since thought, okay, we're going to carry on this tradition, because the fishing, the maritime culture there is huge. It's a big part of their culture. And they have 25 miles of waterfront there, and fishing is a big part of their food. And now they are not able to actually have that sustainability because the Israelis confiscate their boats, destroy them, it's polluted, etc.
Not infrequently shoot.
And
shoot. People in the boats.
I have been out in those fishing boats and been shot at, where the boat has been shot at. It's just a daily occurrence. That is what happens. And they're sabotaged, totally destroyed, and they basically can't do that part of their culture and sustain themselves with the fish that, like they need to. So the Freedom Flotilla, that's our approach, is we sail from Europe down to Gaza, and our intent is to end the Israeli naval blockade of Gaza. And so we have not been successful in the sense of reaching the shores since, but we have been successful in raising awareness. The Palestinians feel like they are not forgotten, which is a very huge message that we have received from them. Many groups that we work with, We Are Not Numbers is a wonderful group that is working within Gaza, getting the voices out, particularly of youth and children. And that is our next mission, which is May 2020, called For the Children of Gaza, because they have over 60% of their population is made up of children. And they suffer the most, as we know, in any devastated area, that they, without food, water, shelter, medical care, they suffer the most. They are the most vulnerable. And so we're sailing for the children of Gaza to end the Israeli blockade.
Did you sail all the way to Gaza?
I did do that on one occasion. I'll step back just a little bit. The very first boat I was going to talk about was the U.S. boat called the Audacity of Hope.
Yeah.
Yes, the Audacity of Hope, gosh. And so there were over 50 Americans on the boat going, and we were leaving from Greece. Basically, we were stopped. That was right during the whole, when Greece was collapsing from its horrible demise financially and exterior, interior pressure. And Israel had a lot of pressure then on the Greek government. So they said, we'll bail you up. So they were also able to say, don't let any of these boats leave. There were many boats leaving from Greece that year.
So Israel used financial pressure on the Greek government to get them to block your ability to
sail
internationally.
Yes. That's our understanding. That's our belief. It is not an uncommon practice with many of these regimes around the world right now doing the exact same thing. And sanctions, too, I'm sure. I don't know the specifics. But anyway, our boat did not leave. We left Greece. We only got about 6 miles out, and we were approached by the Greek Maritime Coast Guard saying, no, there's no way you're going anywhere. And we held them off for a few hours, and then we were taken into port, and that was the end of it. No, they did not threaten to sink us, but they were all totally, you know, in their goon camo gear and pointing guns and, you know, circling us, and we saying and trying to intimidate, and basically we weren't going to go beyond them because they probably would have just stopped us, basically. I don't think, who knows what they were going to do, but they were not going to let us go. And our captain chose also to just stop and go back. So that was the first one. And then there's the Canadian boat, the Tahrir, that we also wanted to take. There were 25 or 28 people, I believe, who had signed up to go on that one. And that one was leaving from Turkey. It was one of the boats that had been held back prior. They moved it over to Turkey. We got there, and the Turkish government again was influenced by who knows what powers. We can only imagine, U.S., Israel, and so only 12 of us were allowed to go. So we had to pare down the crew, and so we left. And that one, we did make it all the way. I believe we were at 42 miles off the coast of Gaza. And when your communications get cut is when you know that they are coming soon. So basically, we were surrounded by 17 Israeli naval craft. That what they do oftentimes is they practice some of their newest tactics when they're doing these exercises with capturing our flotilla boats. And They did an interesting one where they zipped around. We were in a collaboration with a Canadian boat, the Searcy, and they went around and around the Searcy and made it pull into our boat just by going round and round. It suctioned it into our boat and crashed. Luckily, nobody was hurt and the boats didn't sink. But basically, they were doing some different tactics. We'd lined the sides of the boat so that they couldn't climb in so easily. Well, they had also these extensions on their boat where they could climb way up and over. But as we know, as the Mavi Marmara, they have endless U.S.-supported tactics, you know, and intelligence, as well as armaments that they use against these boats and everywhere around the world. And that's what they practice on all of our flotillas, really. So we were stopped, and we were some people were injured. They were tasered. We're a nonviolent group. Freedom Flotilla is nonviolent, committed to nonviolent action, and taken into Ashdod and processed. And then so we were in prison. Some of us 2 days, some of us three, some four and five.
I assume they confiscated your cameras, your telephones.
Unfortunately, being an environmentalist, we did throw some of our stuff overboard because we didn't want them to have access to that information. But and we were minimalists, though. We didn't take a lot of stuff on the boat that was, you know, to exposing of things we did not want them to know. But, yeah, they did. They confiscated. They returned some things, but not all things.
You mentioned
Mavi Marmara.
There was an American citizen who was murdered along with others.
Yes, there was. The Mavi Marmara was one of the most tragic and horrific attacks that Israel has done on our Freedom Flotillas. It was a Turkish boat, and there were, I believe, I'm not quite positive on my numbers, but I think that there were over 200 people on the boat. 10 were murdered, and one American citizen. And we've taken that to the ICC. That's been, you know, it's one of the issues that's been
International
Criminal Court. And there's an ongoing case going now with just the basically the violations of international law.
The judge from the ICC, a woman,
yes,
brave in the stance of pursuing justice that she's taken, is currently in the process of opening and proceeding with an investigation, crimes against humanity that the Israelis have committed.
Yes, and hopefully that will have enough backing and support and pressure to really follow through and dig deep into the many, many years, decades really, since 47 of international human rights violations against Palestinians. And it's really incredible that the pressure is increasing throughout the world as people are becoming more educated. So we're very supportive of that effort.
And do you see the campaign that you're involved in role in increasing the courage to move towards justice, as in the past with South Africa, with Myanmar?
Yes, I do. I mean, I feel so heartened by all of those efforts around the world where ordinary citizens are becoming aware and step up and say, not in my name, no more, and really pushing the powers that be to tend to these total injustices and outrageous, incredible, horrific violations of human rights that are happening across the globe. And the Freedom Flotilla Coalition, being a coalition of 12 countries, it represents so many different parts of the world. You know, we have New Zealand and South Africa and Australia and Malaysia and Norway, Sweden, Italy, Spain, U.S., Canada. And we are very committed to keeping this pressure on our governments, basically, and supporting all of the other efforts, too, that are working toward Palestinian rights.
I read just recently that a lawmaker from Finland was arrested at the Gaza border for trying to cut through the fence.
Wonderful. I did not hear that one. So that's is great. People are very much
showing great courage, because the Israelis murder women and children for a lot less.
Yes, and with this Great March of Return, I don't know if you've heard of that, but many people around the world are probably not aware of it, but it happens every Friday. They took a 3-week break, but there have been thousands. I believe right now there are at least 10,000 who have been injured. There are thousands who have their eyes shot out, and there are, I believe, there are over 5,000 amputees. And that's a very deliberate, it's the Israeli military practicing their tactics. And it's very interesting to see that those are some of the tactics being used at some of the other borders around the world, often U.S.-backed as well. And so that's Israeli trained, yes. And once again, it's the children who are suffering the most, because at these borders, as we know, Mexico, Canada, Israel, and Gaza right there, many, many children have been shot. Many have been killed, many women. Many youth are particularly targeted for the amputation, so they shoot off their legs. And of course, they can't get medical treatment in Gaza all the time, and they are not able to leave. So it's this incredible, just this barbaric conundrum that continues every Friday, actually. So the Great Return March is something that we totally support, and we are not numbers as a part of reporting it.
Being the Freedom Flotilla.
We being the Freedom Flotilla and the U.S. Boat to Gaza. So that is the name of the U.S. Okay. organization, U.S. Boat to Gaza. And right now, we're preparing and fundraising for this very soon upcoming boat. We are in the process of looking for a boat, purchasing a boat, finding participants. We like to have high-profile participants because then we get better coverage. And that is what the Palestinians are experiencing at an unprecedented level right now, where homes are being demolished more than they have been ever. There are more every week.
Palestine in general and the occupied territories?
Yes.
Or Gaza?
Well, in Gaza, because there are the missiles that go back and forth periodically, but in the West Bank, particularly their occupied West Bank, they are continuing to take over and have is Jewish-only settlements that they are creating. So that's a daily occurrence, and many, many people are being imprisoned daily.
Many children.
Many children are being imprisoned, yes, and separated from their parents. Mm-hmm. So that's another incredibly inhumane, and it's a violation of international law, and people need to know and step up and talk to their representatives and say, no more, not in my name.
So many people feel it's a waste of time to talk to your representative. Can you respond to that?
Well, I have to agree with that sometimes. I happen to have a representative who on this particular issue is not going to budge, and he said that, and we have many, many people who talk to him. So then you just go to where you can go, and you get in your own community, you can go to your co-ops and set up boycott policies, or you set up in your community governments. You can set up, we are an apartheid-free city. And New Orleans just recently said, I realized just a couple days ago, I'm not sure how they did it, but they have set up a very pro-Palestinian policy in support of Palestine. So it's not an anti-Israeli approach. It is opposed to the Zionist Israeli government that is violating human rights. So it's basically saying we are for peace and justice. It's really more of a for that. And also, I am opposed, and most of us who are for Palestinian rights are opposed to our U.S. involvement, engagement, insistence on pushing that Zionist regime to do its dirty work.
What's your understanding of the difference between Zionism and Judaism? Israel claims to represent the interests of all the Jews of the world. The Zionists commingle the concept of Judaism and itself. Can you speak to that?
Well, I guess I would say, I'm an associate member of Jewish Voices for Peace, and oftentimes we work, in solidarity with different projects. And I would equate Zionism to fascism and Nazism. It's basically we are superior, and I don't believe that is the tenet of the Jewish faith. I that's not my understanding, and I think it's an aberration of what that religion believes.
You know, before the founding of the state of Israel, as settlement was underway, a number of Jews from Europe who came to visit or settlers wrote letters saying the same thing, that they were opposed to what was being instituted, that they had left that in Germany as it was being run over by fascist ideology.
Yeah.
And yet here it was in the new land. Because first it went after Jews who spoke out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it went after the British who had the mandate and they had the military. And then it went after the Palestinians.
Well, it just goes to show that we have a lot of work to do and that we really can't sit back on our haunches and think everything is okay, even after times after World War II and we thought, oh, things are okay now. But we have to be ever diligent and we have to be aware and supportive and open-hearted and minded to what is going on in our own communities. And one doesn't need to go far to really see the injustices that happen, whether it's, you know, against children or homeless folks or migrants or people of color and faith. And it's really important for us all to engage. We can't have our head in the sand and think that things are just always going to be okay after any given event. You know, we have to just all engage, whatever level we can, too. I mean, people have different ways of, you know, not everybody has to go to Gaza or go on these flotillas, but I think talking about it is number one, and being open to the discussions, and I think helping our schools have good educational systems, because I think those are being hit very hard right now. Funding is being cut drastically on all levels, and I think that special interest groups have infiltrated it in different ways, whether it's with what help practices are allowed or food, the whole food industry in the schools. I think it goes on and on.
History of Palestine.
Absolutely, right? Absolutely. Oh, yeah, the history. I mean, so what I have done actually is I took Howard Zinn's book to my two history teachers here, and they were interested
in
the public school, and they ordered it, and so I'm helping our school kind of get a little more aware as much as I can, as I said, with the presentations and handouts. And so it can happen on all different levels.
Did you learn to be an interesting public speaker, or have you always been able to be outspoken?
Well, I don't know if I'm an interesting public speaker, but I have pretty much been able to be outspoken. I'm constantly trying to improve my speaking skills, but it's not hard for me to be outspoken. I'm not too shy.
You won't be quiet about injustice.
No, I really have a hard time with that. Yeah. And I like to do it in an effective manner, though, so.
And what are some of the tips that you could share about what makes it effective?
I think mostly relating on that personal level, finding out what people are usually fearful of, what their misunderstanding is about, what their needs are, and why they feel threatened or uncomfortable. And I've had some good results with reaching out to folks, and I've had some where it's not worked at all, where they were very entrenched, particularly with evangelical Christians, actually. And that's been a dead end, and that is what it is. And I'd rather be in more fruitful, you know, ground than pursue that. You know, I'd rather have a few more successes than try to push that elephant up the hill. So, I think I can get pretty rabid and pretty excited, and that can be a turnoff. So I'm really working at just being calm and really feeling out where they are at, so that you can reach that level of misunderstanding and fear, and help there be an understanding of, you know, so I can share my information and they can share theirs without feeling that I'm judging it either. That there can be, because I felt very, I was not told the truth. And that I get angry about that our education system did not reveal the truth about this particular situation with Palestine. And we have to fix that, and we can fix it. We have the means. It's not rocket science, but we have to have the will. And so that's part of what Freedom Flotilla Coalition and U.S. Boat to Gaza is. We have the will, we have the passion, and we have the vision to reach out and include people and try to help educate. Right now, our captain, our past captain from the 2018, is in the United States, Captain Herman Rexton, and he is going across the South. He just gave a talk in Florida, and we're hoping to get some in New Orleans and Texas, perhaps New Mexico and California. But he's on R&R because he actually is a captain of a migrant ship. That's what he's been doing since he got off the Freedom Flotilla. He's been captaining a ship in the Mediterranean. And he's a young, incredibly passionate man. He's 30. I believe he's 30. And he's out there saving migrants in the Mediterranean. So it's once you know, you can't know. And he's a very good example. Right. This younger generation that I'm so inspired by, too. I love cross-generational efforts. And I think that's another thing we need to do is, you know, everybody can be an activist in their own right, whether they sit at home and write letters or make phone calls or bumper sticker their car or stand on the corner or talk to their neighbors or, you know, go on flotillas or there's a million ways.
Do you find women more receptive to your views with their, of what you know as it affects them to hear your experience?
Yes, and, I would say women are more receptive to hearing the information and sharing my experiences and their experiences and there being an exchange. I feel men are not shy about sharing their opinion and being very stubborn about it and not having the exchange. But I think that's changing as well. I think there are more men that realize that that doesn't really serve humanity. And so that's very encouraging. But women definitely are much easier to have that engagement. So U.S. Boats to Gaza, with the S at the end of boats. But if you go to U.S. Boat to Gaza, you'll find it as well. USBoatsToGaza.org and the Freedom Flotilla Coalition.org, FreedomFlotilla.org. You can, either way, it'll come up. We have Facebook and websites. And we're looking for donations for the U.S. boats. And we also have T-shirts to sell. They're beautiful T-shirts. And I'm actually the contact for that. But if you go to the site, you will find my email. And I have lots of wonderful T-shirts that says, "For the children of Gaza, we sail to break the Israeli blockade." They're very reasonable. And I would love to sell them to you. But see, other sites, we are not numbers, as I mentioned before. It's a wonderful organization in Palestine, and one of the coordinators was from the U.S., and that's young people who are doing videos and writing poetry. Gaza Speaks, Abby Martin's movie, a lot of the if you go into Palestine movies, there's some incredible ones. Once you punch in,
contact you directly.
Absolutely, yeah. They can contact me directly. It's marniekit@gmail.com. marniekit@gmail.com.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Without a fight, you can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down Gaza tonight. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit tonight.
This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Rashid Khalidi on his new book.
It's called The 100 Years' War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance from 1917 to 2017. This is the best book on the subject. It's an instant classic. We urge people to read it and to listen in on this great interview.
We follow up on the case of the Venezuelan embassy protectors in Washington, D.C. They could face fines and prison.
They were arrested and 2 weeks ago tried. The jury was so confused, the judge had to say it was a mistrial. Will they be tried again? Listen in.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
There's been a century of war on Palestinians by Zionists, whose goal was to establish a Jewish state on their land. More than 100 years ago, a Zionist Congress, meeting in Vienna, sent a delegation of several rabbis to Palestine to report back on what they saw. The rabbis telegraphed, quote, "The bride is beautiful, but she's married to another man." That is to say, Palestine was already settled by Palestinians, who have been there for centuries. Thus, the project of the Zionists was to ethnically cleanse Palestine by any means necessary. It has taken 100 years and 6 declarations of war, and the settler colonial project of the Zionists has been largely successful so far. 3 years ago, President Donald Trump put his young son-in-law, Jared Kushner, in charge of American policy towards the Palestinians. Without consulting them, last month, Trump announced what he called, quote, "the deal of the century." The deal gave Israel large parts of the West Bank of the Jordan River, which embraced territory illegally conquered by Israel in the war they started in 1967, and where 600,000 Israelis have been settled since then. The Palestinians were given several non-contiguous enclaves in the West Bank, plus the Gaza Strip, and told that those were displaced in 1947-1948 war and the 1967 war could never come back to the land the Zionists claim was given to their ancestors by a god thousands of years ago. They were told that they have 4 years to accept the offer. We speak today with Professor Rashid Khalidi about his just-published landmark history, The 100 Years' War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917 to 2017. Rashid Khalidi is the author of 7 books. His writings have appeared in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Los Angeles Times, and the Chicago Tribune. He's the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University in New York and the editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies.
Rashid Khalidi, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
What were the objectives of the Zionists at the turn of the last century? And if you could, please talk about the letter your great-great-great-uncle, Yusuf Dia, the mayor of Jerusalem, aimed at Theodor Herzl, the father of Zionism. You wrote that, quote, Palestine was already inhabited.
Right. Well, he wrote that, actually, to Herzl, precisely. Well, the objective was something that Yusuf Dia realized was unrealizable without a great deal of suffering. And the objective was to create a Jewish state with sovereignty and control over immigration in a land that, as he wrote to Herzl, was already occupied, and whose inhabitants would resist being supplanted, which, of course, describes precisely what's happened over the past century. So those were their objectives. He wrote to Herzl saying to him at the end of this passage, for the sake of God, let Palestine be left alone. And Herzl, interestingly, responded to him, but ignored all of the essential points that Yusuf Dia Khaldi had made.
To further their objectives, the Zionist colonizers got help from the British Empire, didn't
mm-hmm.
they?
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. I say in the book that the Zionist movement originally was a settler colonial movement in search of a metropolitan power. And Herzl tried with the Germans, with the German Kaiser, tried with the Ottomans, tried with the French. Finally, Chaim Weizmann succeeded with the British. And the British, in the Balfour Declaration and later in the Mandate for Palestine, said that Palestine was to become a national home for the Jewish people. And in the mandate, they laid out an extraordinary number of measures that Britain was to take and took to build up a state, a para-state, for this Zionist movement, while at the same time preventing the Palestinians from the great majority of the population, in 1917, 94% of the population, from having any national or political rights. So this was the unequal situation in which the Palestinians found themselves once the British occupied the country, starting in 1917.
What's the Trump administration's plan for the Palestinians? Trump and his son-in-law Jared Kushner have called their plan the deal of the century. Palestinian supporter attorney Noura Arakat said that, quote, they want to put us in permanent high-tech cages and call it peace. Is it a plan to consolidate Israel's colonial takings?
Short answer is yes, Michael. It is exactly that, and it is what Noura called it. And this is not exactly something new. This has been more or less the plan from the beginning, to get as many Palestinians out. Herzl said, we'll spirit them across the borders in his diaries. In 1948, there was a major bout of ethnic cleansing. More than two-thirds of the Palestinian people were driven from their homes or fled in terror. Most of them before the State of Israel, not most of them, but almost half of them before the State of Israel was even established while the British were still there, and the rest afterwards during the war with the Arab states. And I would argue that this plan exactly fits templates that we can see in early Zionist thinking, that we can see in Likud party thinking. If you go back and read the Likud party platform of 1977, it says exactly what the Kushner plan says. There will be one sovereignty, there will be one state, there will be one security authority between the Mediterranean and the river. There will never be a Palestinian state. Israel will control all of Jerusalem. These are objectives that have been sought over many, many decades. And while they were aspirations of governments of Israel, they have now become the policy of the United States. That's what has changed. The United States has tacitly supported these things by funding a settlement, by supporting the suppression of the Palestinians. But now the United States has publicly come out in the Trump plan in support of these maximalist objectives.
So does the deal of the century sustain the one-state reality that exists on the ground?
I think it's meant to cement that. I think it's meant to do precisely that. That is to say, there is only one people with a right of self-determination in this country. It's the Jewish people. There's only one state here. It's Israel. And that's to say, in the entirety of the territory of old mandatory Palestine, what Israelis would call Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, what we call Palestine, in the entirety of that territory, there is only one state, one sovereignty, one security authority, and that is an Israeli state in which only Jews have certain rights, and others have either no rights or limited rights.
Amy Klobuchar, when interviewed by the editorial board of the New York Times for their possible endorsement, said she would keep the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem and would work to restart the two-state solution. What do you think about that?
Well, she said a number of other things that are very disturbing as well as that. And I think that we're seeing a struggle for the soul of the Democratic Party between people who I think are in line with the overwhelming majority of the base of that party in wanting a more balanced and equitable American position, and those who are in line with the position of the traditional Democratic leadership of the party, which is whatever Israel wants, it gets. And we are 100% with Israel, whatever it does, whatever it says. And if we bleat the occasional dissent, we will continue to fund whatever Israel does. And I think Klobuchar is very much in line, and a couple of other of the candidates for the presidency on the Democratic side are completely in line with that position. Others, like Bernie Sanders, have dissented from that position.
Why did the Wall Street Journal kill your book excerpt that they were planning on running? Tell us about the excerpt, please.
Right. To our great surprise, my editor told me that the Wall Street Journal wanted to publish an excerpt from my book. And they said, the Murdoch Press is going to publish something by me? It was inconceivable. I'll tell you a little anecdote from London. My publisher in London said to me, the Sunday Times and the Times have told her, don't send us any books on Palestine. We are not allowed to review those books. So that's the Murdoch Press. The Sunday Times, of course, and the Sun and a lot of other trashy papers in England are owned by Murdoch, as are the Post and other trashy papers here. The Wall Street Journal being an excellent paper journalistically, but the most right-wing paper on earth otherwise. So they said they were going to publish it. They said they would pay the publisher and me for that excerpt. We agreed on an excerpt. The editor of the Culture page, who I happen to know, was in touch with me a couple days before publication, which was scheduled for January 28th, which happens to also be the date that Trump announced his so-called peace plan, and said to me, can you update it a little bit so it can be more in tune with the news? So I did that. And I wrote him the day before it was supposed to appear to say, can you tell me when exactly it's going to come out? And he wrote back to me saying, I have some bad news. And what they claimed was that the op-ed people are completely separate from the culture page, but the culture page has to be connected with the news people. And they said that my excerpt was too close to some things that the news page. Well, obviously there was political intervention from the highest levels. The person who had been in touch with me, I think, was embarrassed, rightly so. He had been the one who wanted to publish it. I said to myself, I'll believe it the day that I see it in print. And of course, it never did appear. And so my editor sent it to The Intercept, who published it with a lovely comment by The Wall Street Journal.
Just as an aside, I co-edited a book called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. Mm-hmm. And the co-editor, along with my wife Debbie, was Frances Golden. And she insisted that we not use a small left-wing publisher, that we try to get one of the major houses. Mm-hmm. And she got HarperCollins, which ironically is owned by Murdoch.
Precisely.
So there we were in the offices of the HarperCollins building, and the corner office and the vice president's office. And I walk in. This is to negotiate the contract. And I walk in and I see on the couch, it's a huge office, one of those offices that looks like a living room. And I see on his couch a pillow with the Queen of England on the pillow. And my heart sunk. And then I looked over to the other end of the couch, and there was a pillow with a picture of Karl Marx on it.
Oh, my God. You're supposed to sit on those things.
You could sit on it. And they wound up publishing it, and they gave us a $10,000 advance.
Wow.
Who knows why?
Well, the Wall Street Journal paid me a kill fee, so, I mean, nice. I suppose I shouldn't complain.
Right.
No, you shouldn't. You should go out for dinner. We're speaking with Rashid Khalidi, whose new book, just an excellent book, The 100 Years' War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance from 1917 to 2017. Rashid, your book's divided into six chapters, mm-hmm. and each chapter describes what you call a declaration of war against Palestine. Why'd you break it up that way? Can you talk about that?
Sure. A couple things. The first thing is, what I try and argue in this book is that this war, what I describe as a war on Palestine, is that and not some tragic conflict between two equally balanced peoples with equal claims and so on and so forth. It's not equally balanced. It's enormously tilted towards one side. Why? Because the greatest imperial power of every age since 1917 has forcefully supported the Zionist project and later the State of Israel. So you're not talking about any kind of equality. You're talking about an indigenous population under attack in order to supplant it with a new population, and that's being done with external support. I break it up into six chapters because I see certain statements or declarations or international resolutions as amounting to declarations of war on the Palestinians, which are then subsequently followed by actual war on them. And so I talk about the Balfour Declaration, I talk about the Partition Resolution of 1947, I talk about UN Security Council Resolution 242 of 1967, for example, as declarations of war on the Palestinians, and I explain why. Essentially, all of these had as their objective erasing the Palestinians and replacing them with a new state, a Jewish state, later on the State of Israel.
British treated the Palestinians with the same contemptuous condescension that they lavished on other subject peoples from Hong Kong to Jamaica, you write in your book. Could you say the same thing about the USA?
Yes. Obviously, the British do it with a certain aristocratic contempt and a certain highfalutin upper-class accent. Americans do it with our flat accent, but it amounts to the same thing. The British not only treated the Palestinians with condescension and contempt, they repressed them ferociously. When the Palestinians revolted against British rule in 1936, 37, 38, 39, the British ultimately brought in over 100,000 soldiers and police and the might of the Royal Air Force. They killed, wounded, imprisoned, or exiled about 10% of the adult male population, Arab population of Palestine. They brought in one soldier or policeman for every three adult males. A huge repressive force was employed over several years to crush The Palestinians. So this was a war waged by the British Empire on the Palestinians in service of British imperial objectives, but also in service of the Zionist project. And at the same time, British officers like Ord Wingate were training, arming, and leading what were called night squads, i.e. groups of militiamen trained to enter into Arab villages, assassinate people, killing them in cold blood, blowing up their houses over their heads, and so on, teaching these militiamen what later became the methods of the Israeli army. And in fact, on the Israeli Army website, it says that, you know, the spirit of Ord Wingate animates the IDF. And I think that's absolutely true. Ord Wingate is described in a book by the Israeli historian Tom Segev by his own men as a psychopath. And I think that says something.
Rashid, in 1982, you and your wife Mona and your two young daughters were working and living in Beirut when the Israeli army attacked. What was that like?
Well, we had been living in Beirut for much earlier than that, and we had been experiencing various phases of what was later called the Lebanese Civil War, though it was much more than that. It was a regional war. The PLO was involved. Syria was involved. Israel was involved. And there were also all kinds of Lebanese factions involved. So we had had a lot of experience of war, including an Israeli incursion, invasion of 1978 of the southern end of Lebanon, by the time the Israelis attacked in 1982. But this was on an entirely different scale. I mean, the Israelis employed 8 or 9 divisions and the entire air force that ultimately ended up besieging West Beirut, together with their right-wing Lebanese allies, and with the unstinting support of the United States, which before the invasion gave a green light, as I describe in the book, to this Israeli invasion and to the aims that Israel had for its invasion. So I call it an American-Israeli war. It's not an Israeli war alone. The Israelis obviously were the ground forces and the air forces and the ships that were bombarding us, but it was bigger than that. Well, it was. I mean, anybody who's lived with children in a situation of war knows that your primary concern is keeping them safe and trying to explain to them what's going on. And we had a lot of difficulty doing that. In 1982, my youngest daughter would have been 5 years old, and Dima had her third birthday, actually, the day before the ceasefire. She was born August 11th. The ceasefire at the end of the siege was August 12th, and that was one of the worst days of bombardment. So we had her party in a day when the planes were bombing nonstop and artillery was landing and so on. We were very lucky that nothing happened to us, unlike so many other people. 17,000 people were killed in this invasion, almost all of them civilians, and tens of thousands wounded.
Michael and I found exceptionally compelling in your book not just the history of the last 100 years of Zionist conquest of Palestine, but that you interwove stories like the one you just told about yourself and your family, which had ancient roots in Palestine. Please talk about how far back your roots are traceable and how it helped you in researching and writing your book.
Right. Well, I was actually doing research in various family libraries in Jerusalem in the early 1990s, when I came across the papers of the person whose story you mentioned, Yusuf Diyad Khaldi, the guy who'd been mayor of Jerusalem and actually deputy for Jerusalem in the first Ottoman parliament of 1877-78. And I was fascinated by this person. And he was one of a line of people in my family who've been involved in various ways in either legal affairs, I mean, have many, many, many ancestors who were judges, going right back to the Mamluk dynasty in Egypt in the 14th century. And some people in the family argue we can trace our roots back further, before the Crusades, and some even argue before that. I think it can be documented to the 14th century, probably earlier, but I wouldn't stake my reputation as a historian on that. Anyway, the family has a long connection with Jerusalem, going back, you know, the better part of maybe 1,000 years, maybe more.
But your father left for the USA in 1947.
Actually, a little before that. He came here in 1939.
Ah, and he never went back. Is that true?
Oh, he did go back. He went back. I describe, in fact, a trip back with my mother after they were married in 1946-47, when he goes to visit Amir Abdullah, later King Abdullah of Transjordan. And they were planning to settle in Palestine after he finished his graduate work here. He was here to do graduate work. He got a degree at Michigan, and he was working on his PhD at Columbia when he went back in 1946-47. My grandfather's house, which is on the cover, the ruins of which are on the cover of the book, we lost it in 1948, and so he was never able to go back, so he stayed here.
And what did he do here?
He worked for the United Nations for his whole career. He worked eventually in political and security council affairs, which gave me an amazing insight into what was going on, because I could come to his office and see what, you know, the documents that were being prepared and so on, and then I could go to the Security Council chamber in the visitors gallery and watch the proceedings whenever I was in New York, which I did, you know, as often as I could.
Well, you've been involved as a scholar and an activist your entire adult life. I was struck by the quote that you used from Edward Said, who wrote that this is a unique colonialism that we've been subjected to, where they have no use for us. The best Palestinian for them is either dead or gone. Mm-hmm. It's not that they want to exploit us or that they need to keep us there in the ways that the Algerians or the South Africans were kept as a subclass. Can you expand upon what his thinking is?
Right. Well, I mean, I quote that because it sort of summarizes something that I argue at greater length in the book, which is that, you know, Zionism has a national aspect. It's also, among other things, it's created both a national movement and a national entity, the State of Israel. Like many colonial settler projects, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, it created a new nation, a new state, a new people. But it was a colonial settler project. And what I'm arguing in the book is, yes, you can walk and chew gum at the same time. There's no contradiction between those two things. The four states that I've mentioned are examples of successful colonial settler projects. But Zionism was different in a number of respects. First of all, the people were not from the metropole. In other words, they were not French men and women coming from France to colonize a country which would be a part of France, as was the case in Algeria. Or English or Welsh or Scottish or Irish or whatever, subjects of the crown who would North America to make it part of the realm of Britain. They were a group, the Zionists were a group of people who sought to reestablish, as they saw it, Jewish sovereignty in their ancient homeland, and had an objective which they got the support of external powers, Britain first, much later the United States, for their endeavor. And so it's a colonial settler movement, but like each one of them, it was unique. It had characteristics that none other has or had.
Your writing is beautiful, Rashid. We'd like it if you could read a passage from the Hundred Years' War on Palestine.
Sure, happy to do that. Maybe I'll read the first couple paragraphs, which relate to my uncle. My great-great-great uncle, of course. He wasn't my uncle. Yusuf Dia El-Khaldi. Let me read those now. For a few years during the early 1990s, I lived in Jerusalem for several weeks at a time, doing research in the private libraries of some of the city's oldest families, including my own. With my wife and children, I stayed in an apartment belonging to a Haredi family waqf, or religious endowment, in the heart of the cramped, noisy old city. From the roof of this building, there was a view of two of the greatest masterpieces of early Islamic architecture. The shiny, golden Dome of the Rock was just over 300 feet away on the Haram al-Sharif. Beyond it lay the smaller silver-gray cupola of the Al-Aqsa Mosque with the Mount of Olives in the background. In other directions, one could see the old city's churches and synagogues. Just down Bab al-Silsila Street, which is the street where the library is located, just down Bab al-Silsila Street was the main building of the Khaldi Library, which was founded in 1899 by my grandfather, Haj Raghib al-Khaldi, with a bequest from his mother, my great-grandmother, Khadija al-Khaldi. The library houses more than 1,200 manuscripts, mainly in Arabic, some in Persian and Ottoman Turkish, the oldest dating back to the early 11th century. Including some 2,000 19th-century Arabic books and miscellaneous family papers, the collection is one of the most extensive in all of Palestine that is still in the hands of the original owners. At the time of my stay, the main library structure, which dates from around the 13th century, was undergoing restoration, so the contents were being stored temporarily in large cardboard boxes in a Mamluk-era building connected to our apartment by a narrow stairway. I spent over a year among those boxes, going through dusty, worm-eaten books, documents, and letters belonging to generations of Haredis, among them my great-great-great-uncle, Yusuf Dia ad-Din Pasha al-Khaldi. Through his papers, I discovered a worldly man with a broad education acquired in Jerusalem, Malta, Istanbul, and Vienna, a man who is deeply interested in comparative religion, and especially in Judaism, and who owned a number of books in European languages on this and other subjects. And as I go on to say in the book, this was the man who wrote the letter to Theodor Herzl in 1899.
Thank you for that.
That was nice. Thank you. That was Rashid Khalidi reading from his just-published book, The Hundred Years' War on Palestine.
What kind of reception, other than the Wall Street Journal, is your wonderful book getting?
Well, it's a little hard to say. It was just published a couple weeks ago, actually 2 weeks ago, almost exactly. It seems to be getting a good reception. I had a review in the New York Times Sunday Book Review, which I didn't particularly care for, by somebody who I don't think understood much of what I was trying to say. But he talked about the book at some length, and I have a feeling that, you know, any reader who is not completely blind, deaf, and dumb is going to maybe pick up the book in consequence. I've had a couple of other very nice reviews in the UK and here. I was just in Britain promoting the UK edition of the book, which is identical with a different cover. And the reception everywhere I've spoken has been wonderful. I mean, we've sold out every copy that was available at the events I've done. And the audiences were extremely enthusiastic. So far, so good. It's early days.
That's the 100 Years' War on Palestine. Rashid, your daughter, who you mentioned, had her third birthday party in the middle of a war, is now a young woman. She's an attorney. She heads up an organization called Palestine Legal. She's a friend of ours, and we've heard her often talk about the Palestinian exception to the First Amendment. And I wanted to ask you about your daughter's work and that exception.
Right. Well, I mean, she can speak more eloquently about these things than I can, actually. But what you realize if you speak about Palestine or you write about Palestine is that there is a ferocious objection to the very opening of the topic. And that people who are otherwise liberal and people who accept that issues of human rights and rights generally should be debated and discussed close down where Palestine is concerned. And there is a chilling willingness to shut down freedom of speech or academic freedom where Palestine is concerned. And this is this almost hysterical opposition to any discussion of Palestine has reached the point now where anybody who criticizes Israel or talks about Zionism or talks about abuses of Palestinian rights can be smeared as an anti-Semite. And I would argue that this is the tactic of scoundrels who can't possibly deal with the arguments being made from the other side and have to shut the debate down out of fear that they will lose any open argument over issues like what Israel does to the Palestinians or what the nature of the Israeli state is, in particular after the passage of the notorious nation state law of July 2018, which says Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people and there's only room for one people here. In the land of Eretz Israel, there is one people with a right to self-determination. What that basically says is the Palestinians don't exist here as a people. That in and of itself should be a subject of debate and discussion. And if you try and bring that up, you're, quote-unquote, an anti-Semite.
How can people follow your work?
I hope they buy the book. It's available in an audio version and a Kindle version, e-book version. I write a lot in various venues like the press and so on. If they are interested in hearing me, I speak in different places all over the country. I'm going to be in Detroit on the 26th of February. I'm going to be in Chicago. Oh my heavens! I think on the 15th of April. I'll be at the University of Michigan the day after Detroit, which would probably be the 27th. In Chicago, I'll be speaking at the University of Chicago. And I probably have other speaking engagements coming up that we're still organizing. In the first instance, I hope they'll buy this book.
It's a wonderful book, and we do encourage readers.
Rashid, thank you so much for coming down to our studio and joining us today. We're very grateful for your good work.
Well, thank you. Thank you both very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's just after 10 a.m. We're going to jump in with both feet here. You're right into Voices for the Animals on your community radio.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.